Okay, thank you so much for being here, everyone. Welcome to this panel. It's called Comedy and Politics. It's not going to be funny, so we're going to talk really seriously about funny things. So just get over yourselves. Okay, this is about, for me, this is a purely selfish panel. I don't really need you. I just want to know some answers to some questions that I've been thinking. I predominantly make plays with jokes in them, and I'm struggling to work out what the purpose of those jokes is and why they exist and why I think all theatre should be funny. Maybe that's not true. Most theatre should be funny. And I suppose feeling a little bit exhausted and tired with notions of satire and if they're working as they should be and what we can do to the way we tell a joke or what the joke is that might weaponize that politically or more excitingly. I thought I'd read a little bit of this thing before I introduce the panel. It's a bit of, you know, a bit of Howard Barker. do you know what I mean? Just diving right in there. With a bit of obtuse stuff. Okay, listen to this. The time for satire is ended. Nothing can be satirized in the authoritarian state. It is culture reduced to playing the spoons. The stockbroker laughs and the satirist plays the spoons. Wow, thank you, Howard. Maybe we'll come back to that a little bit later. Who knows, it might not come up at all. Now, to my wonderful panel, thank you so much for being here. To my left, we have Caitlin Campbell, who is an actor maker, and the artistic director of the Bristol Improv Theatre, which is the first and only dedicated improv theatre in the UK. And she's my friend. then we have Dr. Sophie Duncan, who's from Christchurch, a fellow in English, and is also a dramaturg and a historical advisor, and I hope will be my friend. And Beth Scholler, who is the artist development producer at Nottingham Playhouse, is soon to be the New Work Associate at The Curve in Leicester, and is also part of the party of somewhere else.
I love this.
This is gonna be quite exciting. And is producing a bunch of funny stuff in the near future. And I'd like you to be my friend as well. Good, I'm glad we got that out of the way. So my first question, my first provocation to you is, when I say like comedy and politics, and I've read you my Howard Barker, what that makes you think of or what that brings to your mind, if we go this way.
Oh, okay, cool. Satire, so what calls to mind for me when I think of satire is sort of the stuff that I watched when I was younger and that kind of brought me up with an understanding of political satire. So stuff like Have I Got News For You? I watched it recently and was just like, this is bollocks, this is dreadful. It's so comfortable and kind of bloated and who's watching it and who is it serving? And it doesn't feel like it's really interrogating any of the structural systems, because I think anything that has such a privileged platform is naturally going to serve or somehow, you know, be a part of that platform. And then it made me think of Twitter and the way that, I don't know, satire has become like lightning speed. Like the other day after the LGBT, discussion about LGBT education in schools happened, and I logged on and there were like six versions of the same joke of, oh, you know, if you teach LGBT sex education in schools, children will become gay, and that's obviously true because I studied the Tudors for 6 years and now I am Catherine of Aragon. Like, there were six different versions of that joke and they were all hilarious, but, you know, if maybe satire and that medium is just a way of keeping us engaging with something because the other option is just to be earnestly angry so often that it's completely exhausting. Those are the two things I'm kind of holding at the moment. Improv and satire often are a bit like oil and water, they don't really mix. The second you, I don't know if anyone's done or seen much improv, has a mixed audience. Yeah.
One
that
person.
Guy. Thank you so much. Come to Bristol. but sometimes there's a little joke in improv that if you kind of like ding ding satire bell, it feels clunky because it should be so responding to what's happening between those two people in the moment that the second you reach for something that's so outside of your conversation. So it's quite hard to speak about satire in an improv context. That's three things.
So I'm always really interested when people talk about political comedy in the same way as when people talk about political theatre, because when you qualify it like that, it implies that there's some comedy or there's some theatre which isn't political. And I don't think that really works. I think on a kind of micro level for how comedy is produced, it's quite often to do with either phenomena which are political, so things like sexual relationships or power relationships, or incongruity. And incongruity, I think, is, I want to say always, but there will be exceptions I've just not thought of. So I will say often concerned with disrupting power relationships, whether it's because, you know, high status person is made to look stupid, or because the presence of something where it shouldn't be kind of both exposes the ridiculousness of something being in the wrong place, but also suggests the possibility that things could be other than they are. And also I think comedy and theatre are innately political because they generally involve money changing hands, don't they? You know, you pay to go and see live comedy or live theatre, and if it's subsidised, then that means it's been deemed worthy on some level by the state. And if it's commercial or, well, if it's unfunded, that might mean either that it's not been deemed worthy by the state or that it's commercial, so it's the product of capitalism. And then how things that are necessarily, inevitably operating within those systems can be certain kinds of political, I think, is really interesting and troubling. So I suppose those are the things I'm thinking about.
So many things to think about. Oh, my brain. I think I always come back to like the sort of comedy and political there. Sort of, think about Shakespeare. I'm not a fan of Shakespeare. The fool always is meant to be funny and speaks the truth. Mm-hmm. I think there's something about comedy that is about speaking truth in a way that connects emotionally. It's useful. I think particularly sometimes you say things very earnestly that are truthful, is it either gets people backed up or everyone's just miserable. And if you laugh, there's a sense of hope at the end of that laugh. There's a sense of like physically what happens in the body, there's a sense of hope and a sense of connection with somebody else, like, isn't it? Or like, yeah, and they get indignant. I think that's some of the work that I'm working with that is comedic. And some of the work is incredibly critical and some of it is less obviously critical. But there's such a joy in laughing, and it's quite and I suppose I can sort of very political about being really rude people when you're giving the same thing at the right time. And that's quite a statement of a collective intention and experience.
So scientifically, there's been research done that shows that when people laugh together, they feel more bonded to the people around them. And maybe not just like the people they've come to the theatre with, but everyone in the audience. And so comedy, laughing together creates community. Sometimes we can think that's a really positive thing, or sometimes, I mean, well, maybe you're a lot better than me, but I'm sure we've all laughed at things that then we kind of wished we hadn't laughed at, or we've laughed in spite of ourselves, or we've laughed and then felt guilty, and maybe we've been laughing a bit kind of guiltily or unwillingly around people who are laughing really genuinely, and we feel we've been kind of brought into a complicity there, which I think
is a pressure laugh.
Well, no, maybe sometimes, you know, you laugh and you wish you hadn't, but you don't want to be somebody who's laughed at that joke, but you're with people who are like, I'm laughing because this is funny.
We talked about this earlier, but laughter in groups is often far more about rhythm than whether about something is genuinely funny, and it's a lot more about social cohesion and fitting in with the people around you. So, yeah, I think it's totally easy to find yourself.
And it's a weird experience. I was at a show, which I won't mention. And everyone kept saying, they were like, this show is amazing, it's just the funniest thing you ever see. And I sat there, and I think I laughed at one joke in it, which was hilarious. And the rest of it, I was like, I don't get it. Is this a taste thing? Is this a living thing? Everyone else was laughing really hard, and it was the most alienating experience. But also, it was quite a moment going, yeah, I'm not belonging.
Yeah. It's like every time. I mean, is Mrs. Brown's voice just on every night of the week? They had about 14 Christmas specials. They had a New Year's Day special. Is that even a thing?
No.
Well, I think it's the most successful comedy. If we're going to talk about Mrs. Brown's voice, we have to talk about this notion that you're talking earlier, Sophie, about when we talk about political theatre, we talk about left-wing political theatre.
Which that's what we're talking about.
Yes, exactly. I mean.
Yeah, and that's. We can speculate on all sorts of reasons why that might be, but then we think, well, where's the kind of right? I'm not mourning a lack of political theatre, I should say. But
glad someone said it.
But there is right-wing satire and right-wing comic writing. And if you pick up something like The Spectator. Structurally, the language is well put together, even if you don't agree with the underlying ideology. But if you think of someone like Stoppard, who is probably our leading conservative playwright, who's written some of the most beloved and canonical post-war plays, and he himself is somebody who, and embarrassingly, only we couldn't remember if he was Hungarian or Czech. And I didn't look it up because I couldn't get on the Wi-Fi. But I know that he became naturalized as a result of kind of the catastrophes of post-war continental socialism. And so it's interesting that, I mean, I would say he's a very political playwright, but he doesn't look like one. You know, he doesn't look like David Edgar, for example. So there is kind of right-wing, that is right-wing political comedy, but we wouldn't really class it as such, would we? Which is interesting.
Beth, in terms of the work that you've been... Can I borrow your pen? So you were talking a little bit earlier about this notion of a lot of the work that you're making now is funny, and that sort of changed. Do you think why is that happening? Because I feel like there's stuff that the world needs at various times, and that these things kind of emerge and bubble up. And I suppose thinking about an environment that Stoppard was kind of coming up, and the landscape sort of requiring or needing that kind of comedy or that kind of work. What's the character of this comedy that's being produced now, and how have you seen that sort of change in the last few years?
I think some of it's a reaction to having, say, some of the work I'm doing is quite small scale, and all of it has, I realise that the work I've been developing over the last 18 months has had quite a really strong comedic edge, and I was trying to think about why that was, and I think some of it is a reaction having, from some theatre makers, of having seen so much quite intense political reactions to the climate, of going, I just want to have a good night out, and I want my mates to have a good night out. And I think that, I love that from the audience there, that is really honouring the fact that theatre should be a really engaging and delightful evening out. And if you've had a week of the news and doing an intense office job or whatever it is you do, do you want to go and spend an hour at the theatre having this intense experience of this day? Great, and feel better. So I think some of the work feels like a bit of reaction to sometimes these like intellectualisation of it, although the work I'm making is incredibly clever. Some of it is about a real honesty, and there's something I think to post-truth culture where people are saying really difficult, truthful things that catches people off guard, and it's quite personal and it's relevant, and it people go, oh, yeah, I'm going to connect with that, and there's an amusement to that in the process. One of the other I love their company name. Brilliant. And they make they set up a kind of female comedy sketch show, and they were just really hacked off about women being told they weren't funny. They all come out of a token workshop, and the work they make is incredibly political about the female body and about the sort of lack of knowledge that we have culturally around the female body. And so if you ever grab the artist at director in a bar, like, shall I just share all sorts of things in just a hilarious way? And the sketches they made were brilliant. And interestingly, they went in the studio, and they just sold out every time. And eventually stuck on with a 750-seater. And it was snowing, people queuing out the door for tickets. And you just go, this is such a little amazing show that is just raucous and joyous. But also, you come out going,
I don't know, it's very easy for every generation to be like, we have it the worst and nothing has ever been this bad. But I think there's a really strong sense of powerlessness at the moment in young people, which I count myself among, in the UK, where, you know, it's like we can all see how ridiculous this thing is. The point of satire is to point out the ridiculousness of something, to make us all wake up and see, this is so stupid, we shouldn't believe it, we shouldn't follow it. And because of the kind of structural and integral way that the press, the media, and first past the post and our system works at the moment, it feels like we can all see how stupid it is, and none of us can do anything about it. And so to see theatre that is about that, to remind you of that sense of powerlessness, is could be disempowering. And I think the role of comedy in things like that, in work that is about the situation but can also make you laugh at it, is empowering in some way.
It's resilient, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's resilient.
I think resilient is the word. Because if you can go away having thought about that but also having had a good time, it can make you think, like, I'll go on another day. Mm. Whereas the, you know, the temptation...
Go on.
I'll go on. The temptation to just check out of this, which, I don't know, a lot of us probably in the position to be able to do in our kind of fairly middle-class lives, and don't want to speak for everyone, but to disengage to a certain extent and be like, I'm sorry, that's just too much to think about, the paths and walls. If it keeps us involved in what's happening and trying to make a change in some way, then that's important.
It feels like there's something, isn't it, about a joke. What I'm hearing in a way is this idea of the joke gets past people, opens people up emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
If we can unite people in that capacity, or loosen the room in that way, we can mm-hmm. slip through our political messages
mm-hmm.
maybe a little bit easier, and really just like change everyone, kind of propaganda. You know, are we just building propaganda here and using jokes to open people up?
I mean, I'm entirely comfortable with that.
Yes.
That's what we're doing. I think that's
we were talking earlier about Idi Amin and sort
of,
I think it's quite interesting.
As I do. So we were talking about the idea, it was quite often you see the claim that Trump, for example, is beyond satire.
And Tom said it earlier.
Yeah.
Yes! I'm being like a fool!
And then
Sophie set us straight.
And then I said I thought there was a kind of understandable comic or moral laziness in that, and then it was corrected to exhaustion, which is a much better and kinder way of putting it, because I said, you know, there was a proud tradition of satirical responses to Idi Amin. There was a proud tradition, you know, during the 30s and 40s of satirical responses to Hitler. You know, if you can make satire and comedy about Robben Island prison, then I don't think I can understand why it's like, oh no, this is just too awful, this is beyond everything, but I don't think it is. History has told us that you can make powerful comedy, not necessarily about the atrocities not about the atrocities people committed. And in fact, if you watch something like The Death of Stalin, which is the film by Armando Iannucci, Ian Martin film, and I adore their work, but I think the least successful part of that film is the stuff actually depicting Stalin's terrors. I think that's the bit that doesn't work. But I think you can always go for the preposterousness and the weakness and the littleness of very, very powerful hate figures. And I think that does have, I think it has meaning for the people who are doing it, but I also think it has meaning for the targets, because even with my limited historical knowledge, there has never been a dictator or even a politician who was blasé about being satirized. And if it didn't matter, why would authoritarian politicians and dictators always seek to suppress satire? We know it matters. I mean, look at Trump. Look at the way Trump has a tantrum.
Mm.
And every time, you know, somebody mocks him. So there's lots of tantrums.
Go on,
something you said earlier about the Alan Partridge effect, I think, is interesting and relevant, and you should say it now.
Thanks, Caitlin. Thanks, mate. Okay. I completely agree, and I think I should stop being so lazy. But I think there's something always interesting about the way we need to shift the way we satirize, or the way we do this, because it seems to me that the political character has changed, or there's a new emergence of a political character who basically doesn't really care if they overstep the line, or if they do something bad, or if they are. It seems to me that there's less of a desire to aim for a kind of level of admirability or decency. So the if our politicians kind of stop being Alan Partridge, then it's much more difficult to poke fun at them, insofar as Alan Partridge really works as a comedic, tragic character because he's trying to do his best. And when someone's not trying to do their best and trying not to be decent, that becomes kind of a, it's like trying to, you know,
maybe not.
I know I am, but what are you? Yeah. I feel like I'm in the playground sort of poking fun at someone and they're just saying like,
maybe not trying to be decent, but trying to come across as decent. Like we can all share a video of Theresa May trying to dance and,
Theresa May feels very, feels like Alan Partridge to me because she's so desperately
always on
trying,
the radio.
You know, like, but I think you're right, which is a sense of, that shouldn't stop us trying. What is sort of worrying is something Liv told me, where are you? Hello. The biggest purchasers of political cartoons are the subjects of those cartoons, which feels like a really weird idea, but that you would have. Liv, did you want to? Yes. Yes, and I suppose it's thinking about how do we actually energize that joke. Just before we talk about a notion of actually sort of stepping outside of the content of the joke and thinking about the platform of that joke, and I think it'd be good to talk to you, Caitlin, about this sort of idea of who gets to tell the joke, I guess. But just before we do that, I wonder if we could just talk a little bit more about this idea of uniting an audience versus dividing one, which I think is also a useful quality, which is the moment when you're in the theatre and your neighbour laughs at something that you don't, or you laugh at something that your neighbour doesn't, and what that does to a room in terms of it, thinking about where we are politically. Is the most useful thing for us to unite the crowd or actually divide us into little pockets and understand our difference? Does that make you guys think of anything?
Okay. I don't know if this is a direct response, uh-huh. but to like come at it aside, I was thinking recently that the theatre and the comedy that I've enjoyed most recently is stuff that's been kind of radically kind, like really, and not kind as in like cuddly, but fundamentally about people being good at heart and trying their best. And I think maybe there is something about satire that is by its nature actually quite cruel, and that actually a step away from satire of individual choices, mistakes, individual Theresa May dances, you know, the sense that like all politicians are the same and picking on them individually as people, I think it could easily just be quite disempowering, because it makes you think, well, then there's no chance of changing anything, and you don't see the, you know, a wide opportunity to make change through those systems. And the stuff that I've enjoyed recently, I felt, has been political and in wider strokes, in that it's opposes that sense of cruelty and powerlessness by being optimistic.
I do, yeah. I know exactly what you mean, and I worry about this because I feel kind of as a sort of humorless, lefty lesbian feminist. I cut myself off from enjoying a lot of forms of theatre and television because I'm sitting there muttering to myself. So, you know, I look at the SNL Theresa May sketch or Theresa May dancing, or people saying, you know, God, poor woman, she's having a terrible time. And I think, yes, but she's an evil homophobe, and so we shouldn't be humanizing her. That's disgusting. And then, you know, I watch Fleabag after resisting for like however long it, you know, I've just watched the first series, I haven't watched the second series.
Well, how can we talk about it? Jesus.
No, it's fine.
I'm not
really
going to ruin it for you. It's so good.
No, I didn't want to watch it, and I was very happy about watching it because I was like, oh, a tall, posh woman's got some feelings. I just don't care. You know, a baronet's granddaughter has been enabled to talk about her feelings and anal sex on television. I just don't care. And also,
watch the second series.
But go on, please.
And I was just like, everyone says it's marvelous. I'm not going to get involved. The same thing happened with Hamilton. Then it changed my life. And I'm aware that I'm sort of muttering to myself, oh, you know, this double-barreled girl has
had two series on the BBC, you know, marvellous. Who gives a shit? This isn't, you know, this upper middle class experience where she can just run this cafe into the ground, apparently.
That does bother me.
And it's fine. But then I think, oh, Sophie, you know, live a little. Enjoy Fleabag. And I think it's really tricky because in kind of...
I think it's just really interesting that it's been hanging on my head for a while.
Mm-hmm. What are the economics of that cafe?
How does it work? I mean, who else
works there? Yes. Go on.
But I think there's something, and I suppose it's probably underpinned in the Midlands, and I'm really aware about the political demographics of audiences. And I think so often in theatre and theatre community, like when Brexit happened, I was in London at that time, but I'm very closely connected to region. And like, if you live in regions, it was not a shock. Mm. It was just, we knew this was coming. It was really, you know, it was going to be close, but it wasn't a shock. And for a lot of the kind of London liberal theatre crowd, arty left types, it was like, oh my God, what happened? And I think there's a sort of worrying assumption that audiences are always on the left, and there's a sort of smugness sometimes that it's beginning to really creep into theatre and comedy, which I think will, A, on a really practical commercial level, is going to be really problematic. Mm-hmm. Also, really dishonours the broader spectrum of the country. And if we're in a country that at the moment is really divided down the line on politics and all sorts of and actually, in terms of like comedy, is our job to kind of exacerbate and create those things, to put ourselves into identity politics, like, well, I can't offer it because of this. Mm. Or is it about trying to understand and kind of get together and create much more of a dialogue around what is funny, what does bring us together, and what does this look like? And I suppose, I've been in Q&As after theatre shows where actors have sort of talked to the audience as if they're their left-wing mates in the park. Mm. And I'm sat there thinking, I reckon 70% of the audience is probably either Tory voting or certainly more right. And doesn't know what you're talking about. And I think that we make assumptions sometimes which are really unhelpful and comes from a place of, I don't know, it's not a little bit judgmental, but it can feel that.
That's good, yeah.
And I think, how do you engage with more vibrant dialogue, or how do you engage with people that are more in the centre, or that don't even put themselves anywhere in that political spectrum, but have got thoughts and feelings that come from real life context and geographical positions and who they've grown up with, and where they're educated, and all of that. And I think a lot of that is missing in our comedy.
Mm. Absolutely, and that those circumstances aren't a bug, they're a feature.
This might be very naive of me, but I wonder how many venues there are that will bring together people from very different political spheres.
I would say that most major venues do, because the majority of people, the average age of theatre going to kind of major venues is very, very high. And the classic, you'll know far more about this than I do, but as I understand it, the classic kind of philanthropic donor profile is probably more politically centrist of the right.
I'm going to nod.
That's certainly my understanding of kind of major subsidised venues, that you get these people who, it's interesting, so quite often the people who are giving the huge donations to fund the major programmes of work that is going to pay for bringing in a younger and more oppositional audience are quite often people who are further to the right of the political spectrum than
possibly,
maybe a lot of theatre makers.
But again, I think we have a habit of just boxing people into quite neat demographics. Mm. I think we've got to make huge assumptions about older people going to theatre when they're 50 people. We're quite dismissive in the way that they fund quite a lot more theatre. And that there's a real opportunity there for intergenerational dialogue, which seems really exciting. I suppose who has money and able to do that kind of thing is the question. But also, it's extremely, I think we're really invested in this, generally really love it, and really up for it.
Can we talk a little bit, sorry, go on, Kim.
I was thinking about, Tom worked on a show over Christmas that opened in Bristol, and a friend of mine came to see it and described it as just the right amount of woke. Revealing in some way, but it was fun. It was a comedy, but it was a comedy with its politics like grounded in, you know, not punching down. Sorry. I'm secretly a massive bigot, and so it was meant to be a good fun night out where also you could turn off that side of your brain that's sitting there like a humorless lesbian going, oh, what's about to happen? And it opened in Bristol and it killed, and there were some classic lines in there that just every time was like, just touching a big laughter track button. And then we did it in Plymouth the whole of December, and it was just so totally different. The things that people laughed at were different, and there were times where you could just tell the laughter was different. It was less like, oh, of course, and we're like, oh, okay. Like, slightly taken aback. And some lines that just sank every single time. And because it was quite a living play, like, we devised and rewritten a lot of it, we cut some of the lines that were just not working and replaced them with things that were a little bit more, we thought, accessible. Tom turned up, was like, put them back in.
They need to know.
They need to educate Plymouth. Come on.
Well, it's a really interesting thought about where we place ourselves as theatre makers, insofar as, I suppose, on a level with the audience, above them. Like, where are you saying, when am I educating you with my play? When am I, we're sharing in a room together? And I think it's a really interesting set of conversations. At what point do you say, by saying, everyone sit in a room and listen to me, are you already putting yourself above an audience and saying, I've got something to tell you?
And I think there's also sometimes a misapprehension that that can only be done through new writing and through new comedy, which is probably, I would say, maybe the most overt way of doing that. But I think from a historical point of view, it's really interesting, the moments of great political change when theatres and political systems, which are very radical, reach for things other than new writing. So, I mean, one example would be if you look at 1989 and the fall of the Berlin Wall. So you've got the first pre-election going on in what had been Israel and what had been the GDR. And the Deutsches Theater, which in the GDR had done a lot of new writing that was either kind of socialist realism or sort of throwing offal at the audience and things in a kind of German avant-garde sort of way.
Wow.
the play they decide they want to do for this moment is, and that because it's German, they do it for like 12 hours and you have to commit to being there for the whole day. But what they reach for is Hamlet. And I think that's fascinating. Historically, non-new writing, not just on the continent, but also here, because theatre is Britain's only consistently censored art form. Are the things you can do through kind of performance and casting and subtext and the kind of holes in the text, that there's, I think, a huge potential to do really inventive and politically rich and politically provocative things, whether comic or tragic, not through new writing. And I think maybe that's something that can be embraced as well. But there's the problem for emerging theatre makers that I think, because constantly theatre has to justify itself, doesn't it, in terms of its accessibility and relevance and newness and the new audience it will bring in. I sometimes feel that political theatre makers don't get the opportunities to develop through existing work. It always has to be new writing.
Could we talk a little bit about the sort of, if we sort of step outside of the work itself and think about your work that you've been doing with the Bristol Improv theme. Scene thing.
Theme.
Theme.
You're going to say theatre and then you theme. Started saying theme.
Yes, I did. Please go on.
Okay, what about it?
Well, I'm particularly interested in, I suppose, like, you entering a predominantly male art form,
yeah.
And what that experience was like for you and how you were making changes to include people who might have thought that improv and comedy was not for them.
So I started doing improv at university, at Bristol University. And I turned up to improv because I'd been quite sure that I wanted to do something performing artsy, but drama A-level had just killed theatre for me, really sadly, and I didn't get it back for years, just because I found the teaching style and the directing style so controlling. Mm-hmm. And once our drama teacher sat us all down and told us whether we were a Stella or a Blanche, you could be either.
I feel like that should be illegal.
I mean, I'm pretty sure it was. It was dreadful. And once he told us all whether we were dramatic or comedic actresses and stuff like that. And so I went to university like, I hate drama. I hate theatre. I just want to do comedy because comedy and theatre are totally different to learn. And so I went to Freshers' Fair, and I found all of the theatre things quite cliquey and quite intimidating, because I was very socially anxious in that way when I was younger. And all the people in improv stock were so nice and welcoming, and they said there's a show every fortnight and you can just get on stage and do it as soon as you feel like you're ready, and it's training ground and it's about making mistakes, you just go for it. And I was like, sign me up. And they also, for some reason, were handing out these stickers that were like, wanna meet girls, come to improv. And I was like, oh, funny, yeah, because all of the theatre stuff I'd done had been like loads of girls and women. Like, I don't know if everyone's done that kind of like, we really need boys for the play this year, you've got to join. And I went along after 2 months to the a workshop, and opened the door almost 20 minutes late because I got lost, because I'm a woman, I have no spatial awareness. And all these like 30 heads swiveled, and they were all like, a girl! And there were about 40 people there, two of them were women. And it was just like that for the first year. They were just, every time you got on stage, someone said that you're a prostitute. Every time someone on stage would be like, Mum! Everyone would be like, it's your turn. And it was just boring. But the sad thing is, there were lots of women who would come to one session and not come back, come to one session. And it was just kind of those of us who really like stuck our daggers in, we're like, no, I'm not leaving, and then ran for committee and got it. And just, and it takes a kind of doggedness to be like, no, I'm sure that I'm very funny and very good at this, and you will rue the day that you did not call me into that scene because I'm a woman. And so the next year on the Freshers' Fair, I basically sent like half the people away and told them that they couldn't be on the stool. And then just every girl who walked past, I was like, ever thought about comedy? Ever thought about comedy? Don't say improv. No one's heard of improv. Just be like, have you ever wanted to do comedy? And where all these women would just be like, oh, no, I'm not funny. I would say, if you have ever had this conversation with your best friend where you're making each other cry laughing and you're like, we're so funny, we should be on TV, that is what improv is. It's taking that conversation with your best friend and putting it on stage, and it's kind and it's nice and it's about giving each other space and giving each other time and saying yes to each other, and we will make it that. And loads of women turned up to the first workshop, and all the guys who've been there for years were like, whoa, this is mad, where are these girls coming from? And I was like, no one mentioned anything. And someone told me recently, I've forgotten this, they remembered like 3 months into term when I lifted the embargo on mentioning that there were more women in the society that year. And then we had a female president, and then loads of women ran for committee. And now it's this like wonderfully diverse, queer, full of women, you know, lovely comedy societies. And they produce work that's just more interesting because it's less confrontational. There are less women fighting for space. And something that I love seeing within that society is that there are lots of women in it who aren't very good, because there are lots of men in it who aren't very good, because it's a student comedy society. That's what they're for, right? They're for trying out and seeing if comedy is for you, taking yourself to the Edinburgh Fringe and making a massive mess of it. But there used to be this climate where if you were a woman, you could only stay if you were going to be the best. And I remember in my first year in that society just being like, if you're a woman and you're not good, you need to get out, because I can't bear it if we go on stage and we don't represent. Like, please, don't put her in the show, put me in the show, because I'll like prove to everyone how good we can be. And that kind of like horrible, you know, so counter to improv, where you just feel like you're fighting for your space and fighting for your air. And it's just completely changed now. And with the theatre that I run, we try and have a similar approach. And that's mostly in the classroom. It's about bringing people's awareness to giving each other space.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
Because that was completely
fascinating. Sorry, I went for it.
No. But it was when you were saying at the beginning that when you started and you need to go on stage and your improv partner, who I'm guessing demographically was a man at that point, would designate you prostitute or there would be mum. And so it seems that the problem of the way the women could be represented in improv, it was limited by what men could imagine of women.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And because improv is about co-imagining, I don't really know much about it, but it seems to me that's what it is. But that it takes women to imagine better things for women. So when you've got the women, because we recognise that we can be things other than prostitutes and mums. Mm.
That's literally
a play. Like, maybe it's not just an improv
never
thing.
Never seen every show of yours.
I mean, Harold Pinter didn't imagine anything better for you. And so that was the problem. If improv is kind of is a world created through what you can imagine in the moment, you need to be able to reach for different things to imagine for women, and the women can do that for each other.
Yeah. And you could that's that same argument and logic we can transfer to any panel show or any, you know, there's sort of like that's the lack of representation means that we're really limited in what the joke is and how it functions. And with a more diverse cohort of makers telling jokes, I think it's going to be a much more interesting.
And because you get more diverse audiences.
I think if we're talking about diversity and inclusion and access within the Bristol improv scene, there's women are well represented, LGBT plus people are well represented, it's incredibly white, incredibly, incredibly white. And it's interesting because the ways that in which that we've tried to change that to create, so worked on a project called Stomping Ground last year with my friend Pravani Pillay, my friend Imogen Palmer, and so we just invited BAME people to form a BAME only improv troupe and have a night at the Bristol Improv Theatre where they present their work supported by other BAME artists. And whereas we started running women-only improv sessions and had suddenly had like 200 people say they wanted to come to a taster session on Facebook, we were fighting to get people to come and get interested and come along to it. And going individually to people that we've known or taught in the past and being like, come and join this thing, come and do this thing. And I think the barriers are so different and so much higher, especially in somewhere like Bristol, that is almost like two different cities. Racially, in terms of where people live and how people sort of interact with the city, and that is a huge challenge that I don't know if we're going to sit and talk about inclusion and accessibility, and I'm going to pat myself on the back about how many women LGBT people do it. We haven't sorted that, not sorted that, but approached it properly with race yet, because something Pravanya said, which I thought was really interesting, when she was like, why aren't all these people joining it? Like, I love it, why wouldn't they love it? And after a while of talking to people who had joined, she said, I think there's such a struggle to be taken seriously as a person of colour that to then give yourself a space to be silly.
And to like voluntarily relinquish.
Yeah, control and power is very difficult.
It seems like there's, I wonder if we should have like just a couple of questions. Let's do like two questions. Who's gonna go for it? Adam's too offended he's left.
I'm really sorry, it's not a very small question.
Great.
It's good.
I was wondering if you can talk a little bit about representation and the structural difficulty of it feels like as like British politics get more divided and see the divides way more, like the British Lutheran or the British more and more both sides of the political spectrum are so seen together as like to be converted, and I'm like so guilty of this. And the difficulty of making work that isn't so ingrained that they're not getting people in the room.
I'm glad it's you.
I think comedy is fun. So I think getting people in the room isn't such a difficult thing. That's less of a problem. But I always think it's about using that kindness, actually. You can be ruthlessly funny and savagely funny, but also, is there an affection in it? Is there a kindness in it? Are there assumptions you make that are lazy? I think there's something about specificity in comedy that always makes it better. And when it's sort of lazy tropes, it becomes really boring, and then it becomes dismissive, and then it becomes this thing about othering and about tribalism. And there's something about specificity and finding that connection, that identity with people, because there's things that are nothing to do with kind of their politics, actually joining together. Otherwise, I'm speaking in a very sort of generalistic kind of way. I should think of it like a really good example. I suppose, like, look at something like comedians like Gavin and Stacey. And the lovely thing about Gavin and Stacey is, like, nothing really happens. And, like, my favourite bit of the whole thing, if you've seen it, is the bit where the guys in the kitchen are picking a leg of lamb and they're discussing ovenless. And there's something about that just tickles me, because it just goes across sort of all sorts of things, but we all have that thing to teach
ourselves.
And there's an identity thing where you identify the situation and you go, where's the detail in comedy that allows you just to come together in that moment and find that thing? And then you can put in other stuff that's more positive on both sides. You can just from what you're making and the story you're trying to tell. And I suppose that's the other thing, is that in the context of, I suppose, more comedy for anybody, is more that story.
Mm-hmm.
And where does the whole trajectory of the story, and what does that provoke, and what does that challenge? And the lovely thing about story is that it's about the story, the completion of the story. I suppose like with when you're doing more sketch comedy, it's much about the short snappy ideas, and it's much more kind of overtly criticised. So there's a difference in how you kind of create that work and draw people into it.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the Gavin and Stacey, I think, is such a brilliant example, because, as you say, nothing really happens, but we care so much about the not happening. But the Oven Gloves moment is lovely, because there's many funny things happening, but it's not, we're not meant to think that what's funny about it is that it's ridiculous for men to be discussing Oven Gloves, or that it's the fact that the men are obsessing over what they're getting. Before the Christmas special, love the Christmas special, with the turkey.
Yeah.
Like, how are they going to do the turkey? And the men are obsessed with it. But the joke is never men, lol, kitchens. Like,
yeah.
Why are they doing this? They're probably gay. You know, which is the road that a lot of comedies, I think, would go down with that. They're aimed at quite a kind of general audience. And so it's never lazy. It is always specific. And it's never, and it's very kind. All those characters love and care about each other.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, for me, is basically the thing that I really love in comedy is character.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's because then you get the three-dimensional element of the person. I think it's maybe in social media, it's so easy just to see somebody, what somebody's saying, and maybe as a person.
Mm-hmm.
My family are quite politically all over the spectrum. And there's some difficult conversations being had, and I always have to be like, actually, it's really important that I go meet and have a pint in the pub, or actually sit down and come face to face. And I think in the theatre context, being in the room with people, you can have big conversations, you can have, get beyond the sort of simplicity of where you sit on the spectrum and go, you're a person.
Yeah.
And then in comedy, characters are people with real lives and detail.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what, I feel like I need to wrap up at this juncture. I'm feeling really inspired and excited, because it's reminding, I think this, the big notion to emerge from this, I think, is about this notion of kindness, that comedy doesn't need to mean snarky, doesn't need to mean, and that we can still be punching up, and we can still be speaking truth to power in those in those ways, but it doesn't have to be with that cynical edge that we've sort of become accustomed to on our panel shows, I suppose. It reminds me of sort of that David Foster Wallace notion of, I just say it every time I've got an excuse. I'm really sorry. But just that if we're a generation raised on The Simpsons, for example, we're raised in a postmodern age. And so our baseline way of interacting with the world is this notion of cynicism, right? So what we're yearning for is an idea of like true romantic narrative, something that the Gavin Stacey, that we can actually believe in those characters and them getting on with their lives. And I think this notion of specificity is really important, that we can celebrate our difference in that and our similarity, and that the Oven Gloves notion, you may not have done that with Oven Gloves, but you can enjoy the that we can place ourselves within those stories. So that feels like a really exciting way for me to move forward in thinking about comedy. I mean, I told you, it's not about you, okay? It's not about you. It's just about my practice, okay? No, thank you all so much for being here. This has been incredibly exciting, and thank you so much to the panel.
Thank you.